Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The COVID-19 health pandemic has changed our lives in many different ways, and some of these changes could be with us for quite a while. Vermont's judicial system has also had to respond to this health crisis. Most non-emergency legal proceedings were suspended in the middle of March, and criminal and civil jury trials were also put on hold. What steps is the judiciary taking now to gradually reopen the court system? And will the pandemic have any longer-term impacts on the way that justice is delivered in Vermont? With us today to discuss these and other key issues involving the court system is the Chief Justice of the Vermont Supreme Court, Paul Reiber. Chief Justice Reiber, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back on the program. Chief Justice Reiber, one thing that some listeners might not be aware of is the role that the Vermont Supreme Court plays in overseeing Vermont's entire judicial system. Would it be fair to say that the Supreme Court is administratively in charge of the court system in Vermont?
Yeah, that's right. Under the Constitution, the Supreme Court wears two hats. One is decision-making, and that is what I think most people are most familiar with. But the other is that we sit as a board of directors, if you will, to administer justice throughout the state, through all the courts, judges, we license the attorneys. We have a court administrator, very capable, Pat Gable, and staff who report to us ultimately. We have frequent meetings. I can tell you that we've spent untold number of hours since the problem with the virus emerged in meetings through the computer. We've had many hours of meetings. It's been a challenging time, but yes, the Supreme Court is very much involved.
So take us back to the middle of March. The threat of the coronavirus is now becoming very real. There are enormous concerns about the spread of the virus in Vermont. Lawmakers are considering a plan to leave the State House and work remotely for the foreseeable future. What were your thoughts as you realized that this health epidemic could really stop life as we know it in Vermont and that the state's entire judicial system might have to be put on hold?
Yeah, it's daunting. To put it mildly, people have a right to access the justice system in order to resolve disputes. The justice system is necessary to maintain order through the criminal justice system. It's been very, very difficult to have to move individually. Move as an institutional arm of the democratic system in the state to have to move to isolation. One of the things that I think maybe people don't actually think about very often, the justice is a very human undertaking. The decisions that judges issue are obviously personal decisions, individual decisions. It's very important that judges act in a detached manner, applying only the law. But the fact is also that we rely upon a very close human interaction in order for the system to work properly. Lawyers in a courtroom need to be able to confer with their client in a private, confidential manner, even during the proceedings, even while the proceedings are ongoing, so that a lawyer can whisper in a client's ear, and vice versa, so the client can communicate back, obviously without disrupting the proceedings. We have witnesses who come into court to testify and sit in a chair next to the judge in the courtrooms across the state and right in front of a jury of typically 12 people. And these 12 people are charged with, and it's a very important responsibility that they undertake. It's critical to the ordinary operation of justice under our laws and under our Constitution that people will be judged by their peers. But they sit right next to each other. Look at any jury box in the state. The jurors are elbow to elbow, shoulder to shoulder in chairs arranged in the boxes. And in fact, when they deliberate, when the jurors deliberate, they go into a closed room in the courthouse behind the courtroom, and they sit together for hours, sometimes days, sometimes even weeks, together in close proximity to one another while they discuss the case and work out a resolution to it. So all of these things I would point out are extremely important to our serving the public, our fulfilling the responsibilities we have under the Constitution to the public. They're very, very important actions that have to be undertaken, and all of this has come to a halt.
You know, Chief Justice Reiber, it seems like a lot of the business community and others have used Zoom technology to hold video meetings. For all the things that you just mentioned, the important interaction between people in the court system, I'm getting the impression that as the court starts to reopen in Vermont, going to some kind of electronic video Zoom system is not really in the cards.
Well, we're wrestling with it. We're trying to figure it out. You know, we have a planning committee chaired by my friend Justice Harold Eaton and colleague Karen Carroll that has been working heroically with other members of the court administrator staff and the court administrator herself and the chief administrative trial judge, Judge Grierson, for over a month. They issued a report that's publicly available on our website, a ramp-up report, if you will, and we began to reopen our courts the first Monday in June. I think it was June 1. But it's very, very difficult. The practices and procedures that we're putting into place are novel. They're new. It's not necessarily practices and procedures that everybody is familiar with, of course, because they are new. We're trying to learn as much as we can from colleagues in other states. The National Center for State Courts, a very important organization down in Williamsburg, Virginia, has been extraordinarily helpful with webinars that many of us, if not all of us, have watched. There was one I attended a couple Fridays ago. There were over 2,000 people, not just around the country, but around the world, that were participating, trying to learn and brainstorm ideas about how to reopen courts in a way that is safe. You know, one of my colleagues, great colleagues, Beth Robinson, wrote an important comment to the administrative order that we issued initially on March 16th. That we've amended several times since then, but that's also publicly available on our website. And in the commentary that Beth wrote, she pointed out the tension that exists in the courts between these competing concerns, she called them, of public health on one hand, and access to justice on the other hand. And so this has been the challenge, and this will continue to be the challenge. But believe me, we have such great people working in the courts, Bob, as I know you've heard me say before, and it is absolutely true. Terrific, terrific, hardworking people who are very dedicated to service to the great state of Vermont, and I'm sure we're going to get through this.
Chief Justice Reiber, you were talking about the competing concerns and the tension of health and legal issues. When the court decided to postpone all jury trials for a number of months, did you have to weigh that decision against the Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution that says that defendants have a right to confront their accusers basically in a speedy and public trial of their peers?
Yeah. I mean, that is one of the issues that I was talking about. One of the issues that we were and are reluctant to walk away from. But on the other hand, were we to proceed with open courts, to proceed with face-to-face hearings and jury trials, we would, in effect, be ignoring the science that's behind the public health concerns that are expressed by the governor and others for our state and more broadly across the country, and in doing so, place people's health, individual health, in jeopardy, if not worse, and thereby, I think, jeopardize the integrity of the judicial system itself if we are not respectful of these very serious public health concerns. We're effectively doing damage, I think, to the very system we're pledged to protect.
Chief Justice, we got this email from Todd in Heartland, who wrote us, "While normally the court would not give a timeline for releasing any decision, but would the court consider releasing a schedule for pending decisions, particularly so-called civil litigants might have the ability to plan and have a rough idea of when to expect a decision, because right now it could be a month or 2 years, and civil litigants will likely wait the longest."
If Todd is talking about Supreme Court decisions, our court has been operating as much in a normal fashion at a normal pace as you might expect. We, in fact, I counted up. I testified last week to the House Judiciary, and I counted up before I did that. I think we've had at least 50 cases that we've taken on between March the 16th and this would be a week or 2 weeks ago. I think it could be as many as 60 or 70. And we've been holding hearings over a WebEx platform where we've actually had virtual connections through the Internet with lawyers, in some cases with parties who have not lawyers, they have no lawyers and are coming into court without a lawyer. We've entertained those arguments as well, and the decisions in these cases are moving apace as best we possibly can. We don't populate the courthouse. None of our courthouses in the state, by and large, are populated. There are exceptions. And, of course, since June the 1st, there's been more activity in individual courts around the state. But we placed a hold on March the 16th on all cases except for emergency matters of the kind of we postponed all jury draws and jury trials. We did allow arraignments to go forward for defendants in custody, criminal defendants in custody, of course. We permitted juvenile temporary care hearings and emergency motions to suspend parent-child contact in juvenile and domestic cases. These are examples of the things that were permitted to proceed. So decisions in those cases would, I expect, be coming in the ordinary course. But if we're talking about a civil suit of some kind, if Todd is talking about a civil suit of some kind,
I think Todd was talking about the Supreme Court specifically.
Okay. Well, I would hope we're moving at our pretty much our normal pace, except that, believe me, the meetings have been almost constant, so that has interrupted some of the workflow.
Let's go to our listeners and start with John, who's calling from Vershire. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Thanks to the Chief Justice.
Yeah, John,
there's a lot of information, Chief. Yes, I appreciate it very much. There's a lot of information right now. I'm a scientist. What's going over in Iceland, and there's no mandatory mask rule. People are without masks, and their cases are significantly lower.
Huh?
Excuse me?
Where are you talking
over
about?
Over in Iceland. Over in Iceland.
Iceland. Oh, okay.
Well, yeah, and cases are significantly, the transmission rate is significantly lower per capita in America, certainly, and Vermont. The IQ is also higher per capita than America, and they do not have a mandatory mask rule at all. So I just wanted to make sure that we're listening to the science. These are conspiracy theories. Anyone can look them up online. It's real straight shot talk here. And I'm just wondering why we're wearing the masks. Is it for fun? And or I hope it doesn't become mandatory. Thank you very much.
Bob, could you repeat the question? I'm not sure I caught it all. It was garbled. I'm sorry, his voice was a little garbled.
Yeah, I think John expressed some concerns about mandatory mask requirements and that they were unconstitutional. It's interesting to see that we're seeing it in Vermont's retail reopening, that both stores can require their employees to wear masks. And in some places, some municipalities, they can also require all customers to wear a mask.
Yeah.
And I also noticed, Chief Justice, that there was a ban in Ohio for people, or in Ohio, there was a rule that people coming into the judicial system needed to wear a mask, and the Ohio Supreme Court said, no, that's not allowed. People need to see each other.
Well, I haven't heard about that, and I stay pretty I'll reach out to my friend Maureen O'Connor out there and find out if that's the case. But I stay pretty close to the news, what state courts are doing around the country, and I sure haven't heard about that. But let me say this. If you come to a courthouse, you got to wear a mask. That's our rule, and it's a sensible rule, and we're following the science. The risk that is at play here is a significant and substantial risk, and particularly for older people who are compromised, and anybody who has a compromised health situation of one kind or another. We are a system of justice in our state, and this is true across the country, where people don't come, by and large, because they want to be there. You go to a store to shop, that's a voluntary act on your part. That's different. We are telling people that they must come to court on certain occasions, and so it's not an act that is one that we're controlling in effect. And I think our judgments, the judgments we're making about keeping faith with health directives and the science that we understand is out there, are consistent with the responsibility that we're exercising.
We did get this email, Mr. Chief Justice. What is the Chief Justice's prediction on the future of jury trials? Will there be virtual trials? Also, how does he think the efficiencies found as a result of the pandemic, like not having to travel or needing office space, will affect the legal profession? Let's start off with the future of jury trials. You mentioned all the important elements of a jury trial, starting with 12 people in a jury box and people, attorneys and defendants being close together. What do you see as the future for jury trials in Vermont?
I think the jury system is an important, even a vital tenet of the justice system in our state and in our country. I think it's very important that people are involved in the justice system. We have lay people, for want of a better word, who are involved in many, many aspects of the administration of justice, and I could go into that, Bob. But it's really important to me and to my colleagues, I know, that we have the good common sense of people who are not a professional, professionals of one kind or another in the system that are involved in decision making. I think it is a very important balance to our duties. So I think juries will be back, and I think it's going to happen. Our present order postpones all criminal jury trials until September 1, and all civil jury trials until after January 1. And that those dates are subject to change. They're not cast in stone. We will reflect on the choices we've made as new information comes in, and modify them if it appears that it would be in order. There was an opportunity a few weeks ago to watch a virtual jury trial that took place in Texas, right outside of Dallas. This was something that was facilitated again by the National Center for State Courts, and a number of us watched it. It was live, and they essentially had 12 people, I think it was 12, something, it may have been even more, who were appearing on, it was, I think it was on YouTube, they broadcast it through YouTube, they were appearing, but it was a Zoom platform. I think that's the case. Anyway, mm-hmm. each of the jurors were appearing using their smartphones. So when you watched it and watched the lawyers ask questions of the jurors, they were picking a jury. When the judge addressed them, each of them was in a separate window on your computer screen, and you could see them when they talked. You could watch them even when they were not talking. And it was, a fairly successful exercise. It was an advisory jury, it turned out. There was no decision that was actually made by the jury, but it was a pilot that they tried, and I think it educated a lot of us about the importance of technology in trying to get going again. Of course, the limitation for us, and one of the lessons learned, I think, that I would talk to you about and talk to the listeners about, is how important it is that we have good broadband in this state that reaches all corners of the state. This is a very important thing, and one of the limitations we've learned in the work that we've done since March 16th is that there are hiccups, there are glitches in connectivity with people who have attended Supreme Court hearings, for instance. There are glitches and hiccups with connectivity in some of the meetings that we've held with different folks around the state. And a lot of this depends not only upon the quality of the broadband that's available in the location that the user is calling in from, but it also sometimes depends upon the quality of the technology they're employing themselves, which and by the way, it raises an important other question, and that is, how are we going to address the needs of folks who don't have smartphones, who don't have a computer, who don't even have access to transportation to get to a public library where they might be able to access a computer? These are, you know, the question of rural justice in a state like ours is a very, very important one, and one that, believe me, we've been thinking a lot about, and actually was some of what I testified about with the legislature.
Let's look at that case that you mentioned in Texas of a live video trial and the members of the jury being there using Zoom on their smartphones. I think probably everybody listening has had Zoom experience in the last 3 months, and sometimes in meetings with 10 or 15 people, the experience can be very different than if you were meeting with those people in person. Would you have any concerns about a jury that deliberated over Zoom and not in person?
Yeah, absolutely. And your question is right. It's spot on. The judge in the Texas case when at the beginning of the jury selection process, went through a litany of instructions with regard to their obligations not to employ, you know, the technology that they were using to connect to the court with and later would connect with each other, that they not employ it for purposes to gain information that was not presented through the trial process itself. This is similar to the instruction, by the way, that judges give juries in every case when their physical presence is there, that they refrain from during recess, or if it's a multi-day trial, in between days, that they refrain from discussing the case with anyone, that they not use any means to access information about the case, because jurors are pledged to consider only the facts that come in through the justice system, through the work of the lawyers and the witnesses, and the instructions of the judge themselves.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Timothy in Middlebury. Hi, Timothy. Welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Hi.
One second, boys.
Over there? Yeah. So, can you pop your trunk real quick?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I have a question for you. Give me one second. Sorry. I'm at the food.
No, I can't.
Well, okay. We're going to have to. Timothy, have you got a question for us? It sounds like you got a lot going on. Okay, well, we lost Timothy. Sounded like Timothy was multitasking, which can sometimes be a difficult thing to do.
Something we're familiar with, yeah.
Chief Justice, we got this email from Carolyn who wrote, I'm concerned about the court's recent decision requiring the release of persons held without bail pre-trial for violent offenses because the court is unable to hold jury trials within a 60-day period. Are there any proposals to address the risk this poses to public safety?
I'm not sure what decision she's talking about. And, you know, that maybe she's thinking of another state or another jurisdiction. Decision for release of individuals before trial who are charged with offenses is in the hands of individual judges. And as I indicated before, one of the exceptions to our order in March that suspended all court work effectively, one of the exceptions to that was for people who are being held in custody charged with a criminal offense, because that is, you know, that's an important problem. So we accepted that, and there have been hearings that judges have held in jurisdictions throughout the state of Vermont, counties throughout the state, where they have considered a bail and release of accused defendants on bails or conditions on bail or conditions of release. And in fact, the Supreme Court has heard on multiple occasions since the middle of March appeals from those bail decisions. There's not been a blanket decision from our court. I think she might be thinking of another state.
Let's talk to Bob, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure to talk to you. You know, I have a situation. I'm a senior citizen, and I have I'm not just taking advantage of the whole situation that you can't evict anybody right now. Chief Justice, when do you suppose that's going to change? You know, half of my income is from this apartment. I own a duplex. I'm losing a lot of money that I count on to live.
Yeah. Well, I hear you. This is a concern that has been raised on both sides of the aisle, if you will, both by landlords and tenants, and I very much appreciate your concerns. This is an example of how the justice system needs to be working, needs to be in operation, in order to resolve legitimate legal disputes between parties like the one Bob is talking about. There understand it, I think there was a moratorium placed on evictions where the landlord owns property that is subject to federal financing of some kind or another. I believe that's the case. A legal aid lawyer could tell you better. But the question of all of those other situations beyond whatever the federal implication might be to landlord-tenant relations is something that's been under consideration in the legislature now for, I think, at least for a month. I know they've been taking a lot of testimony on it. I can't tell you exactly where it is. I can't tell you either precisely what the legislation says that they have under consideration. But I know that it is a concern on both sides, both with respect to the landlords who depend upon rent, not only to pay their own bills, but to make sure that they can continue to make mortgage payments so that the property is not fall into foreclosure. And the same thing with tenants and the problem of people winding up on the street without housing, sometimes with families, and not only without housing, but in a atmosphere where it may be very, very difficult to find substitute housing. So these are serious concerns, and we understand them, and not just myself, but I know the entire court does. We certainly appreciate these concerns, but it's something that's in front of the legislature right now, as I understand it.
Bob, thanks for your question. Let's turn to Joe, who's calling from Eden. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Yeah, my question was, how does the justice feel on, you know, the emotional impact and the connection on jury trials and such from defendants on being in person? And it seems to me from observing trials in the past that if they were, you know, virtual, it would distance the connection, and just kind of his thoughts on that and how that would impact the fair defense of defendants.
Yeah. I thanks, Joe. I think that's a great question. I think that the, I have a weekly telephone call with leadership in the bar, Beth Novotny, who's the president of the Vermont Bar Association, and Terry Corsones, who's the executive director. And it's really been very, very useful. We've been doing it since the order started. This is an issue that they've raised. What is the impact on decision-making by a judge or a jury where the parties themselves are appearing by video, virtually, not in their physical presence? One of the concerns the bar has raised that is linked to this is, will lawyers who appear virtually at a hearing, not at a trial perhaps, but at a hearing before a judge, where maybe the other opposing attorney is physically present in a courthouse, which is possible now that we've begun to reopen, will their interests and their clients' interests be treated differently? It's a very interesting question. It's not to say that we haven't employed video accessibility for some time in a number of different ways. As I indicated before, the Supreme Court's been doing hearings for, you know, all these months now virtually. But even before that, we had entertained not only video connections from parties, but also telephone connections. Quite frequently, we'd have folks on the phone in addition having the physical presence of a lawyer in the Supreme Court room in Montpelier. And the same in the trial courts to some extent. So it's not entirely novel. I think it's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to it. And I think that it's something that we will ponder going forward.
Let's talk to Tom, who's calling from Stowe. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. What is the status of small claims courts in the state of Vermont?
The small claims courts, those processes like the Judicial Bureau are gradually reopening. The problem with a reopening of those cases where most of the parties come into court without attorneys is that our firm instruction is that the judges, and it would be the hearing officers as well, maximize remote connection to the court so that the physical presence of lawyers or witnesses or parties is absolutely kept to a minimum. In other words, it'd be rare, if ever, that individuals would come into court. So I think the complication for moving small claims cases forward is because of our interest in minimizing the physical presence of people in courthouses. Remember that the part of the concern that we have is not only with the public at large, but also exposing our staff and judges to the potential of contracting the virus. We're effectively, we're not, again, we are asking people to be mindful of the possibility of communication if they do come to the courthouse, because, we've got trained folks who are doing great work in the courts. It's very difficult for us to replace people. And as a matter of fact, one of the particulars with the report that I mentioned that's on our website is that courts will do no more than 5 hours a day of actual courtroom work. That's in order to allow staff to have the opportunity, sufficient opportunity to complete their other work while maintaining social distancing in the offices in the courthouse, while maintaining all the other protocols that are adopted. So hearing small claims cases, hearing judicial bureau cases is very much in flux, I would have to say, for the moment.
Tom, thanks for your phone call. Let's talk to Dennis in Cambridge. Hi, Dennis. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Good afternoon, Judge.
Good afternoon. How are you, Dennis?
Very good, thank you. I'd like to get your views on potential income disparity or bias in these virtual trials, virtual jury trials that we spoke about. Not only are there differences in broadband connection and computer equipment that people of different income levels are likely to have, there are also likely to be home situations where a person who is of more modest means might not even have access to a private room or a space where they can be private and avoid distractions. And I think we have a good example just a few minutes ago when Timothy called in, and apparently children came on the scene and was interrupted. And if that was a jury trial, he would have might have missed that critical point.
Yep.
So, I don't see...
That's an excellent point. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Dennis,
I was wondering about, if that could be a consideration.
I think it is. I'll tell you something I have to say publicly, because I've said this to the legislature privately off and on for the last few years. In my heart of hearts, there's some jurisdictions. This is not a novel idea to me, but if we had a bus, we could drive the bus with a court into towns and villages that where people really don't have access to justice, where they need access to justice. Bring the bus in, open the bus up on Saturday mornings, not regular hours. One of the things that I've always been conflicted about was the fact that we ask people to come to court during business hours. Of course, this is because we follow the ordinary rules of maintaining a business, of course, during regular hours. But at the same time, it's difficult for some people to come to court and lose a day's pay. And so to the extent we could schedule to avoid that kind of consequence to folks, I would say would be a good idea. On the other side of the ledger, let me say something about the business community, because I think that is an area that also needs attention from the courts as much as possible. I have friends in Rhode Island where the courts down there have opened a very interesting docket specifically tailored to the business community to help try to, and I won't go into all the detail, but to try to protect not only small business in the state of Rhode Island, but also the you know, the jobs that that they provide. I'm not sure how that system is going. I know they started it about a month ago, but it's a good idea as well on the same line of thinking.
I'm sure, Chief Justice Reiber, you've got a lot of people thinking about the court bus rolling into town and are very intrigued by that possibility in taking the court to the people.
I told the Judiciary Committee the other day that I'm thinking seriously about getting a CDL, so that might be moving it in the same direction.
Chief Justice, we seem to be in this country's history at a tipping point for calls for criminal justice reforms following the killing of George Floyd roughly 2 weeks ago in Minneapolis. Is there a role for the court to play in addressing these issues? How do you see that unfolding?
Yeah, you know, I sent a letter to a group of folks down in Washington last week about funding the Legal Services Corporation, which is the main target for congressional funding to provide civil lawyers for folks who can't afford one in all kinds of range of different matters, small claims, landlord-tenant, all of those things. And in it, I said to the to the board, I said, you know, it's been tough watching the news for the last couple of weeks and not have some mixed feelings about the integrity of our justice system in this country. I certainly think that the question of racial injustice is an extremely important one. I have felt this for a long time. It's not something, you know, if we could only, those of us who live in more privileged circumstances, try to understand what it's like to live in the shoes of folks who don't. It's not just that black African-American minority communities are disadvantaged economically. There's a terrible bias and prejudice. I'll tell you a quick story. I was at had a great opportunity last November to attend a conference in Jackson, Mississippi, and speak to a group of high school students, black high school students. There are 200 or 300 of them from around the country. Speaking at that conference, and I wound up having lunch with him. Andy Young, the former ambassador to the UN when Jimmy Carter was president, mayor of Atlanta. Andrew Young spoke to these young people in an auditorium at Jackson State University. I was so taken with his stories, and I won't tell you the stories, but I could, that essentially he was trying to help these young people understand that nonviolent response to the kinds of excesses, the physical confrontations that they will experience and have experienced in their lives, is the way of the future. And what got me was the fact that this conference, which happens every year, there'll be another one this year. I told them I hope they'll invite me back again. and I hope they have it. The fact that that we are living in a society where this generation, that generation, Andrew Young's generation, there are many other civil rights heroes that were at this conference. Those people are having to talk to young people about trying to control their temper, trying to control their response to injustice. And I just think it's a terrible thing, and it's certainly not what this country is made of. And I know that we could talk about the details of that and what the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution says, but not our Constitution, by the way, not the Vermont Constitution. So I think what is the role of courts in this? I think we follow the law. That's what judges do. That's our job. Bottom line, we follow the law. We apply the law. That is, we are not an alter ego of the legislature or anybody else. This is what our job is. But at the same time, we are in positions of authority and leadership in the government. I think we have a responsibility. Listen, let me put it this way, we need leaders in the bar of Vermont, on the bench mm-hmm. of Vermont, of people of color. We need that. We want that. I want to be clear about that. That's a very important thing. There is strength through diversity.
And we're going to have to end our conversation right there. Chief Justice Reiber, running out of time, but we thank you very much for your taking the time to be on the program today.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks very much.
I'm Bob Kinzel. Thanks for listening.